From the Lynn DeGrant University in Urbana, Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 30th day of June, 2026. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about this morning's USDA reports with Naomi Bloom. She's at TotalFarmMarketing.com. We'll delve into what it takes to be innovative on the farm as it's related to conservation, and then we'll turn our attention to the weather forecast. Ed Kieser will be here. That's a name many of you will likely recognize. He'll be in for Don Day this afternoon right here on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Medium. It is public radio for the farming world online on demand at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Naomi Bloom from TotalFarmMarketing.com now joins us to take a look at how the market reactions were to the USDA grain stocks and acreage figures this morning. They were released at 11 o'clock. You and I are talking about an hour later because I'm hosting a webinar throughout the day today for University of Illinois Extension on succession planning. The succession here is that the prices went up and they have knocked back just a bit. Can you start with the numbers broadly for me as it's related to acreage and how they compared to what the trade was expecting?
Absolutely. So corn acres today came in at 95.3 million acres. That was unchanged from March. Trade thought that maybe the acreage number, like the average guess, was 94.9. So it is a little bit higher than the average estimate, but within the range of estimates. And I think the surprise is that there was no surprise. Usually there's some sort of unforeseen something on these reports. And on the soybean side of it, soybean acres came in 85.4 million acres, which was right on the average estimate. And that number slightly higher. First number of 84.7. So no big surprises there. Looking at wheat kind of is the one that is supportive overall. And as far as like the planted acres for wheat came in at, they came in for all wheat at 42.7, a little bit lower than the average estimate of 43.8, a little bit lower than the March 31st number. But the biggest thing about the wheat number today, in my opinion, was the focus on the winter wheat acres. So the winter wheat acres came in at 31.5. That was below the March number of 32.4 and below the estimate, the average estimate coming in today of 32.4. So that was supportive, and that's why wheat is up at about 12 cents at this time. But when you look at the harvested acre number, just because of all of that drought that the plains had, harvested acres at 21.2. So the USDA acknowledging the problem out there in the plains with the drought. And I think that's going to give the wheat market some general support going forward, but we're still in that situation where there's, at the moment, plentiful global supplies.
Given those numbers for wheat, did they simply get abandoned? They were not harvested and abandoned? They didn't clearly transfer, apparently, to any other, and I didn't see the breakdown by state, but they didn't appear to transfer to some other crop, did they?
Right. No, I think what you initially said about abandoned acres, or just as guys were getting ready to do some harvest, they just realized that it might not be worth it. So abandoned acres, I think, is the theme here. So I haven't seen like any specific wording from the USDA, but that's kind of what the trade chatter has been. And that coincides with what clients have told me. It also coincides with how fast the harvest has been going this year, because if you don't have a crop to harvest, harvest has a tendency to go faster than the average pace. So wheat today, Kansas City wheat, again, up about 10 to 12 cents today on this news. maybe trying to find a short-term low, but it might struggle to rally again just because the short-term perception is that global wheat supplies are sufficient.
Anything from the grain stocks report that was of note?
Well, the theme is that we have more supply than last year. So corn quarterly stocks came in at 5.295. It was a little bit lower than the average estimate going into the report of 5.39. But when you look at where we were last year at this time, 4.64 for carryout on the quarterly stock side of it. So that's the resounding reason why July corn futures got down to $4 the last 2 days, because we've got old crop supplies available. On the soybean side of it, quarterly stocks today came in at 1.061, slightly higher than the average estimate of 1.05, and pretty close to where we were a year ago at this time at 1.00. So from that standpoint, comfortable supplies of soybeans, but it does set us up to make sure we have to watch August weather. And also, I'm still of the strong opinion that when we find our harvest low at some point in August or early September, it's going to be big low, and we're going to see a lot of end users come in and buy and a lot of other countries come in and buy for their import needs. So we're going to see strong exports later on this summer. But anyway, the report today, the USDA punted, no big shocker, which is the shocker, because usually this report has some sort of dynamic volatility response to it, and we got nothing today. But we'll have to just go back to weather watching from here.
So why is it that both corn and soybeans managed to rally at least for a while after the market's release, after the USDA release?
Yeah, I think two-part. One would just be initial computer headlines and computer trading as the report came across. The other part of it, corn especially, corn had been so oversold going into the report, and the fact that we got nothing that was over the top negative, it made the marketplace have a little bit of a recovery bounce on short-term profit-taking. So people who were short, they're buying back those positions. It's also the end of the month position squaring. Tomorrow starts a new month and a new quarter. So we can maybe see a little bit of weather premium getting back built back into this, just because it has been so warm. And if the rain showers do not materialize later this week, then we need to put weather premium back in. So maybe a little bit of a short-term bounce here, but history says that if corn does get a bounce here into 4th of July weekend, a lot of times that's another opportunity to be making some sales for old crop and new crop.
Thank you much, Naomi.
Thank you.
That's Naomi Bloom. She is with TotalFarmMarketing.com. Did you know cover crops are the only in-field practice with both nitrogen and phosphorus reduction efficiencies? Cover crops are used on about 1.25 million acres in Illinois, and while that sounds like a lot, it's just 6% of the 21 million cropland acres in the state. University of Illinois Extension, as it did with no-till starting in the 1970s, is working hard to change the culture around cover crops. There are, of course, many barriers to overcome. Something new Extension has been trying is called FLASH, or Farmer-Led Advances for Soil Health. There are financial incentives within the program, but more importantly, it puts farmers in touch with each other to explore cover crops and to talk about what they've learned. These groups are localized, so it's easy for them to grab a cup of coffee and get together. We'll do something like that today. University of Illinois Extension's Rachel Curry hosted a farmer panel on this subject. It included Adam Dahmer, Greg Thorin, and Brent Fowler. She asked the three of them to talk about their operations. Adam and Greg told stories of conservation-minded families and landowners. Brent, on the other hand, had a different experience. And part of that, he admits, lands on him.
Listening to Greg and Adam, our story is a little different. The main challenge that I have faced with conservation is probably been my family. And I mean, I love my dad. I love my whole family, but that has definitely been the biggest challenge. My dad he's ex-military, so he's very structured. He likes to do the same thing every single day, and he likes to do the same thing every year. And I kind of joke with people that I like trying new things. We're definitely different in that way. And I kind of have an uncanny ability to question everything my dad does or ever has done. And so that can be a little bit challenging at times. But I like trying new things. I like testing. I like comparing different practices. But that's definitely been hard. And I know that, well, one of the things that kind of got us started in no-till, and we are almost all no-till now, but we had a worker that went to a field by mistake. He was supposed to take our plow, our ripper, and he took our vertical tillage tool instead. And a long story short, the field did really well, and it really got me questioning if it was really worth it to plow all of our corn stalk fields every year. So I remember I went to my dad and my grandpa at the time and said, I want to do some tests. I would like to try a test of the vertical till and not plow the whole field. And they really hated that idea. And I also kind of joke with people that, the only thing I can kind of compare it to would be for a non-farmer to paint your living room but leave a strip in the middle unpainted. And that's how my dad and grandpa felt about it. But they went along with it, and we started doing tests, and the results were showing that it really just wasn't paying to do all that heavy tillage. And so over time, we did that for several years, and then we started where we were, only plowing half the field, and we did that for a few years, and then it got to where we were, only plowing a strip in the center of the field, and the test just kept showing that the minimal till or no till was better. So that's kind of how it started. But another thing that I kind of think about too is that ditches or gullies and fields really bother me. And I know dad doesn't like it, but dad can go take a field cultivator and fill in the ditches in a field, and it doesn't really hurt him as much as it does me. And I look at, that soil left our field and it's never coming back. And so that's what really kind of led me to, so when I found out that we can do some of these conservation practices and keep our soil in our field and be more profitable, that was really exciting when that happened. So, and now we are trying. We definitely do a lot of cover crops now. Almost all of our corn stalks before soybeans have a cereal rye cover crop. So that's kind of our story.
Again, that's Brent Fowler. He farms in the southern part of McDonough County. That's about an hour east of the Iowa-Missouri border on the Illinois side. Now, his initial barrier to adopting conservation methods on the farm was, let's call it, institutional. Why on earth would we change? That's not the barrier, conservation or cover crops, that Adam Dahmer ran into. He farms in Williamson County. It's in deep southern Illinois. Just trying to learn how to use and manage cover crops has been his biggest problem.
As far as challenges are concerned, I would say early on, back in the late 90s, it was information. We started with cereal rye in front of soybeans and corn stalks, and the whole purpose of that was build organic matter. We successfully were doing that, but nonetheless, we still wanted to figure out how to get it across all the acres. As we moved forward, the industry grew a little bit, and we were able to source good seed and so forth to move forward, and that allowed us to expand our operation. The biggest struggles I see most people with is the mindset on how to achieve it. You've got to change your entire scope of how you approach your equipment purchases, as well as your management practices. I really don't care what color piece of equipment you drive. If it doesn't work in the application, it is of no use for this operation. And that's the mindset that often holds most people back, is they are diehard a certain brand, even though that particular piece may not be best for the diversity that they're wanting to implement with cover crops. So we've always kept a real open mind as far as what equipment and so forth we were using. As far as seeding goes, that's probably one of the biggest hurdles that I hear, is guys can't get it in the field. We've done it. We started with airplanes. Drills, of course, by far the best. And we built a high boy seeder in 2013. That worked good, but nonetheless, the drill still outperforms it. Drones work very well. We've implemented those more and more as we move forward, as they don't get the cover crop seed tied up in the whirl of the corn plant like other seeding methods do before harvest. But as far as challenges, I would say that would be the only ones. I mean, the biggest challenge most operators have is their mindset, because if they do not keep an open mind and convince themselves they're going to make it work, they're destined to fail. So I can't really speak as far as anything that's really prohibited us from expanding other than our own mindset. And we've been pretty progressive on that.
Mindset. I can do it. We can do it. We should change. Greg Thorne, the other farmer on the panel discussion, agreed with Brenton Adam. And then he went a step further, thinking more broadly about the reasons behind the change and the good he is doing.
I agree with everything that Adam and Brent said. I've experienced those things. The barriers might be, looking back now, it's a completely different management system. And it's a unique holistic management system. And maybe this is for some that's more advanced, but as you start, we started with cereal rye again, like Adam did. That's a no-brainer. We did it for erosion purposes. And I truly believe that no matter what cover crop you use, if it's a single species, that it does so many more things than just one object that you want it to do. That's the fun thing about this. We as farmers think if you do one thing, you get this one return. Well, with cover crops, it just does a tremendous amount of thing, like any plant does. So I think that was the big takeaway for me. And then of course nowadays we're into multi-species cover crops. We try to plant at least four different families at a minimum for soil health purposes. And then, of course, we're getting into the soil health arena more as the public even. And that's a very, very good system, because basically it all comes back to clean water, clean air. If we can get the soil health better, the system just makes sense. Mother Nature just makes sense how she does things. And we've basically disturbed her a lot with our conventional farming practices that we have today.
Again, that's Greg Thorne. He's from the Driftless area of the state in the far northwestern corner of Illinois, where the soils were not covered by glaciers in Joe Davies County. He, Adam Dahmer, and Brent Fowler all use cover crops. Each is from a very different area of the state. Yet they all have a common thread that runs through their farms: conservation and innovation. In future episodes, we'll take up some of what that means on the ground and in the ledger. We'll hear about profits versus yields and how to get it all done with planters, drones, and timing. Let's turn our attention now to the global growing regions. Ed Kieser is here. That's a name many of you will be familiar with. He has now returned to Illinois public media, at least on and off. And today he's going to fill in for Don Dame at Dayweather, who's away. Thanks, Ed, for being with us. It's been such a long time. Glad to hear your voice.
Well, it's great to be back. I'll tell you, I feel like I'm at home. Came back to the station last week on Friday, and it's just been great to hear from so many people. we still have a lot of listeners from back when, I can tell you that.
I know we do, and they'll be surprised to hear you as well. And really glad the ag audience, I know, really appreciated your time here. Glad to have you back. So let's get right into it. It is hot across the Corn Belt. It has also been wet in many places. Give me your assessment of the weather forecast coming up.
Well, as we go into this 250th birthday for America celebration this weekend, it's certainly going to be a hot start in a lot of the country, from the Mississippi Valley all the way to the East Coast, including all of the Corn Belt. It looks like the peak of the heat is today through Thursday in the Corn Belt, but that doesn't mean it's going to turn significantly cooler Friday or Saturday. Temperatures will still get up into the 90s. It's just the chance for scattered thunderstorms starts to spread across more of the Corn Belt as we get to the end of the week. It looks like over the next couple of days, the rain will be confined mostly to the upper portions of the Midwest and Corn Belt. That includes northern Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin. Those areas are getting some deluges, and that's because that's where the edge of the hot dome is, and a lot of times you'll get storms forming right along that edge. So for the next few days, that's where the bulk of the rain will be, and in some cases, too much rain, several inches. But the rest of the Corn Belt will be mostly dry through Thursday, and then it looks like scattered thunderstorms start to pick up in coverage a bit as we go Friday into the weekend. And that will be leading into, I'll just say, slightly cooler air for the start of next week. We may have a couple of days where high temperatures are only in the upper 80s as opposed to the 90s, and the heat index may get below 100 for a few days. But it does look like there's a chance next week that heat will start to build again, especially in the western Corn Belt. It looks like there will be a little bit of an adjustment to the pattern where the heat will be shifting a little farther west, and then the eastern Corn Belt will be less hot, and we'll have a little bit better chance for scattered showers and thunderstorms.
Those scattered showers and thunderstorms would be of the Ridge Rider type, and really I want to ask about further out as well. I know that's more difficult, but those two things. The scattered showers are just coming around the top of the high, correct?
Well, right now they are, but there will be a little period where they'll be a little more widespread as we get a little bit of a transition to where the high is located. But again, I think we will get back maybe into that Ridge Rider pattern. And that's something we'll have to watch once we get beyond the 4th and into the middle of July. It appears that maybe there will be a little bit of a better chance of those coming into more of the bulk of the Corn Belt. There's still some question marks on the details of the exact location of where that will all set up, but does look like the ridge of high pressure is shifting a little bit farther to the west starting next week.
Ed, it's really great to have you back on hand at Illinois Public Media, and thank you for being with us here today.
My pleasure.
Ed Kieser is a meteorologist with Illinois Public Media. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report on this Tuesday afternoon. Be sure to visit our website at willag.org. That's willag.org. You have a good afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.